listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As of press time, the week is only halfway over, and yet it's been quite a busy one. From the firing of Rex Tillerson as U.S. Secretary of State, his replacement with now outgoing CIA Director Mike Pompeo, a new director at CIA, Britain's Prime Minister, threatening Russia's President Putin, and much more, we spoke with global analyst Mark Sloboda, based in Moscow, to try to sort it all out via Skype Wednesday. Well, Mark, let's see. I don't know where do we start?
Yeah, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. Thanks for having me, Don. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
Our pleasure to have you, too.
Where do you want to start, Don?
I don't know. Okay, so, I mean, for me, you know, I always like to look at, this is what we see, this is what they would call the apparent in philosophy, and this is what's actually going on, or the essential. And, of course, the two are so unrelated in the modern age that it's almost impossible to divine one from the other, except to say that that which I see, all I can say about it is that is definitely not what's happening. So we're seeing Trump dismisses Secretary of State Tillerson, who was an early appointee, probably a very good one from the point of view of trying to stabilize the administration in the early days with the assault it was under, particularly on foreign policy. People tea leaf reading on what that means for U.S. policy. Did the deep state win some backroom game and now they're bringing in the generals? And I'd especially on that particular point like to get your perspective as a former military person, U.S. military, because, you know, here the perception is that if you have generals, you know, next to power, that somehow the U.S. is more militaristic. But in a society that has 800 military bases around the world whether you have generals or diplomats or priests or nuns in charge. It's a militaristic society, and you know, with when your main export is weapons and or bombs personally delivered to a variety of locations on the planet, I don't know if having a general closer to the Oval Office makes you more or less militaristic. But we now have Pompeo and then the generals all around Trump. And what does this mean at first?
Yeah. First of all, I have to notice it is rather ironic because if you remember in the closing days of the election campaign, Trump rather famously and rather loudly on Twitter and elsewhere attacked America's generals. He had big problems with them, and he was lambasting them left and right, and he was speaking in the plural, as in all of them. Then once he took office and he was trying to form his cabinet, I think there was there was so much fight back against so many of his nominees that he resorted to picking some of these very same generals. I mean, a unreasonable number of them.
A lot of them.
All right, a lot of them, and some of them still uniformed serving generals like McMaster, who is still in uniform serving as the national security advisor.
He did though during the campaign. He did have a couple of generals that Flynn, one or two others that held out as like, this is a good guy right here. You know, this is hero, etc. There were some, and then there's also. When he put the generals in, he was engaged in this, which he's still engaged in this fight with CIA. And so you have already on the ground before Trump, the war between the Pentagon and the CIA in Syria. So there's all that, too.
Well, Flynn is of course, rather interesting character because he was kind of a maverick, despite being appointed by the Obama administration to the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Mm-hmm. And then he was kind of very quietly dismissed from that role towards the end of Obama's presidency, and then he went to the Trump campaign. He's a rather interesting character. He is not bound by establishment views across the board, although he is one of the biggest Iran hawks out there, although there's no shortage of those in the Trump administration, Pompeo.
Or in the Congress.
New Secretary of State.
The Congress, for that matter, too. You know, when they did a month or two ago, the sanctions, Iran was one of the three. They got 517 out of 535 in Congress. So the whole government's like that.
As a former military, I do not approve of generals, certainly not the number that it are in civilian roles in the government. Not at all. Mm-hmm. That has been a divide in U.S. politics. It has not always been strictly adhered to, but it has been kind of an unspoken, maxim. Of U.S. politics, certainly having a general, recently having left the surface, much less someone named Mad Dog, a Marine general, serving as the Secretary of Defense. As a former military veteran, I like the idea of a civilian serving as a head, as a counterbalance to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so on. The whole mess of the Pentagon, on the other side of the Potomac. Right. So it makes me uncomfortable. And the number of generals, that surround Trump and by all intents and purposes control him. Right at this point, particularly on foreign and military policy, it's frightening. And this latest move with Rex Tillerson. Rex Tillerson is, I think, we have to be very, very nuanced with Rex Tillerson. First of all, Rex Tillerson was the CEO of Exxon. Right. And being a person who's concerned about climate change and environmental destruction and everything, that would seem to make Rex Tillerson, at least in some respects, the equivalent of Lucifer, of Satan
incarnate. Darth Vader, whatever.
On the other hand, unlike Trump, Rex Tillerson clearly acknowledge climate change and that it is a problem.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, there is that at least. Yeah. Rex Tillerson, of course, was famous when he was first appointed, when he was first nominated, I should say, of being attacked, of being too close to Russia. Because as the CEO of Russia, of Exxon, he had had numerous business dealings with Russian oil majors, right, including Sechin at the head of Rosneft, right. You know, very close to Putin, having met Putin before, and even having been awarded the order of friendship of the Russian Federation, right. By Putin, no less. Now, this is let me tell you first of all, this is really overblown. You know, Rex Tillerson, right. You know, is an American, and he certainly did rise. You know, if there was any question, you know, whose side he was on, you know, that has, you know, very should have been quickly dismissed. Right. He was a you know. Certainly no great friend to Russia during his, you know, last year, right. year in office. It's only been a year, I guess.
Right.
But that was one of the principal reasons that he was attacked during the nomination process, and that he was a Russian stooge, and this was all part of Putin's plan. He was a Russian puppet, and Trump was a Russian puppet, and so on.
As absurd as that is, the CEO of ExxonMobil, not generally your average Pinocchio. Okay, now, you have the largest corporation in the world, I think, right? Still ExxonMobil?
Yeah, still ExxonMobil.
Okay,
yeah.
They make you CEO, you bring in record profits, you maneuver around the globe. I mean, and of course you're talking to Russians that have oil and gas reserves, maybe, you know, huge ones. It's like if you're the CEO of McDonald's, you're talking to cattle ranchers and soybean farmers and whatever else, because that's the business.
And Russia.
Right, okay.
And the Russian government.
Okay, again, right, because they do that too,
they need
right.
to be here. Believe me, there are McDonald's everywhere here.
And like, Argentina, you know, and whatever. So, you know, all of that is obviously nonsense. They were trying to, you know, tie him into the Russian narrative that was being woven.
He's a businessman, and he's a pragmatist.
Right. But also, like a businessman extraordinaire, that being my point. Like, if there's somebody that's not going to be the puppet of some government official somewhere, if you're going to pick and choose out of the general population, I would start with the CEOs of major corporations who are more likely the puppeteers than the puppets.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly, yes. I mean, there is that he had his own interests and the interests of his class of people, right. You know, being global oil and oligarchy right. and so on. But it's rather ironic that he was pilloried as a Russian puppet when he was hired. But when he was fired yesterday,
right.
this the public announcement of it coming right on the heels, hours of his coming out and accepting the British narrative of this poisoning of this British double agent, supposedly by a Soviet produced nerve agent, Novichok, right. which the British government, without any evidence, is blaming just on Russia,
right.
simply by the fact that the weapon was produced in the Soviet Union. Never mind that it spread to, you know, all the major powers of the world have access to that at this point.
Yeah, right.
And many not major powers and so on, but now that is being called as because he said that he's been fired because he was too harsh on Russia.
Right.
So he goes the narrative shifted in 1 year from being too soft on Russia and Putin's puppet to he was being fired because he was fighting back against Trump on Russia.
Right. In other words, Putin's now, puppet Trump fired the Tillerson for saying bad things about him.
Now, there is a very confused narrative going back from numerous, you know, of the major U.S. publications, the Washington Post, AP, and others, about how actually Tillerson was fired. Of course, it's been talked about for months now.
Right.
But and some a lot of the Russiagate conspiracy theorists are jumping on this thing about Russia. But evidently, he was told twice in the last week that he needed to step down, and that if he didn't, there would be an announcement. This is the latest coming from AP now. Mm. It's still murky on the details, but he cut short a trip to Africa last week, claiming he was ill. But it seems that this was actually the reason. And there's some question of whether he received the final official word in Trump's rather public and crass, I think very undignified. You just, whatever you may think of the man, right? You know, you don't fire a U.S. Secretary of State with a tweet. Right? It's just it's not done. Yeah. And so that's a poor show there. You know, as you know, someone who generally supports Russia's foreign policy position via the United States, I have to say that, you know, Rex Tillerson's time in office, he was no particular friend of Russia, and you know, I disagreed with Rex Tillerson on many issues, but like I said, I think we have to take a nuanced view of him. He was presiding over huge budget cuts, which are necessary. The State Department was bloated and was spending and involved in so many redundant organs that were also being performed by intelligence agencies that the State Department had no business doing, was so involved in military's policy and other things. And of course, this sacred cow of democracy promotion with the National Endowment of Democracy.
Which is also intelligence, basically, really.
It's the CIA. Meddling.
That's right.
It's meddling in let's be honest. It's meddling in other countries' affairs. Exactly. You know, the whole Russiagate narrative has been screaming against.
Right.
How dare someone else do, you know, and Carnegie Mellon, you know, in the last couple of years put out a report detailing how the United States, you know, only up till 2000, you know, not counting all of it since 2000, and not counting coups and regime changes, coups and overt regime changes, military intervention, the U.S. interfered in 81 elections around the world.
Right.
And that's only up till 2000. I think the number only skyrocketed since then.
Right.
So, you know, there's that narrative there. I was pleased to see the budget cuts to the National Endowment for Democracy. The neocons and the Russiagate crowd were going crazy in the Congress. So he was no friend of Congress. He didn't have many supporters there because of that and because of his overseeing the staff and budget cuts in other areas of the State Department. But I did. I think the State Department was bloated. I think it was involved in clandestine activity, which is what National Endowment for Democracy, U.S. aid, you know, being involved, being caught red-handed in several attempts to destabilize and overthrow the Cuban government just during Obama's terms.
I mean, I don't know. Is this claim even controversial? I mean, you look at the revolving door between the people at the State Department and the various NGOs like, Amnesty and all of that, who generate these human rights reports, targeting the same people the State Department and the CIA are targeting. Here's a report now from, Victoria Nuland, who's now with, Amnesty or whatever, Watch, Human Rights Watch. Oh, they're a bad guy. Okay, go get him. In the military, but it's like it's all one team. It's like watching a hockey team.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about the facts, but it is still considered not done to actually acknowledge the facts,
but
to discuss them and discuss the import and the context and everything. It's this 15-minute memory. They might recognize them, but then they forget them, and that they don't intend. The journalists never include them in their overall assessment of comparative, international events. What's going on?
I mean, the relevant part of it, though, is here is that this is what Tillerson is up against. It's really one enemy. Part of it is under his employ on his payroll, and another part is out there trying to take down the president and trying to promulgate a foreign policy from the last administration, regardless of what Tillerson or the president intend, particularly with respect to Russia.
You brought up the whole human rights thing, which I think is another important thing, that Tillerson just blanket refused to at least as loud, anywhere near as loudly as his predecessors, use human rights to weaponize it, the issue of the U.S. hypocritically yelling about other countries' human rights, and of course only its enemies, not its allies like Saudi Arabia and so on, and to use that as a tool weapon, of foreign policy, of public propaganda.
Right.
He just didn't do it. And that really annoyed a lot of people in Congress, that are in the democracy promotion business. It annoyed the neocons. In fact, in the State Department's annual report against Russia and China, where it lambasts them for their you know, presumed human rights violations. He didn't even attend.
Right.
And there has been the leaked memo where there was literally senior people within the State Department were basically informing him and his staff, look, this is what we do with human rights. Literally, right. We use it as a tool, as a weapon to attack our enemies, and we don't talk about it with our allies. I mean, that it was that explicit. Like they had to explain it to him, and he wasn't doing it. And I find that, you know, that's understated role that you know, his handling of being Secretary of State, his quiet, pragmatic, go about, do business of review. I found it refreshing after John Kerry.
It's real. It's a real business person. I mean, again, this one of the things that gets me watching commentators, for example, people who really do nothing but either read off of a teleprompter or read out of their memory of the teleprompter life that they led, you know, working as a functionary somewhere, talking about Tillerson when he's looking at this stuff and understanding it and dealing with it as a peer at least. Okay, he's a former CEO of ExxonMobil, going into these meetings, knowing as much about what's going on as anyone in the room, and having these functionaries mock him as being ignorant because he doesn't take briefings from people that he probably wouldn't hire to serve him coffee in the private sector.
Now, I agree with you. I think he was, you know, one of the adults in the room, as it were, holding Trump's hand, and he was probably, being all things being relative, one of the best of those.
Right.
He disagreed with Trump on numerous things, which is why he was fired.
Yeah.
But he didn't do so publicly. He didn't make a political stink about it. He disagreed on Qatar. He disagreed on trade. He disagreed on climate change. He disagreed on North Korea. I mean, that's the long list. I mean, it goes on and on, you know, of why he was fired at, you know, at the end. It's been, you know, been talked about for months. And it has to be said that he's not the only one. Steve Goldstein, the Undersecretary of State, who immediately came out and tried to challenge the White House version of the exact circumstances of how of Tillerson was fired. He was immediately fired then as well, hours later.
Yep.
And there are lots of rumors floating all around of other major changes, whether any of these will come to be true or not. But there's talk about Kelly, the general who is the chief of staff. Evidently, Trump is very not happy with him. Evidently, Kelly, among other things, it restricts which websites he's allowed to look at, and you know, Breitbart not being one of those, and so on. Whatever you may think of Breitbart, I mean, it's almost like he's, you know,
or of the rumors, but
he's allowed to tweet and what he's allowed to tweet and so on. I don't know how much actual control he has of that. It's questionable. But also McMasters, who evidently there's been a report out in Foreign Policy, who has personality conflicts, being a 3-star Army general, with Kelly and Mattis, who are 4-star Marine generals. And evidently it ended up, rather than being a perfect cabal of being some kind of personality conflicts, ego conflicts between the three of them. So there's talk about him leaving. That wasn't leaving.
Right.
And evidently Tillerson and Mattis had a very good relationship. They evidently started each week meeting each other and talked to each other 3 times a day. And they made a very big show of always going into the Oval Office with state and defense on the same page, as they put it. So,
you know, that's a grown up approach.
That's done.
You know, you're looking at maybe. I mean, and let me ask you this: could we be looking at? I mean, you know, you have this first year and change where Trump has got to basically get the lay of the land, and where he was under massive attack. You know, all kinds of traps were set for foreign policy with the firing of all those diplomats, and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff that went on at the end, bombings and whatnot. Is it possible that after a year of putting, say, you know, he's had Tillerson holding it down at state so no catastrophes happened, and he did good analysis, even if I don't agree with the conclusions, et cetera. Could Trump be reaching a point where he thinks, okay, fine, I think I have a pretty good idea how this stuff all works now. Let me put my people in place and start road testing it. Do you think that's where we are?
I don't know. Who are we replacing him with? Mike Pompeo, who just comes from the director of the CIA. He's a neocon among neocons. He is, you know, I think, I think it's fair to say, an Islamophobe. Yeah. He is a Russia hawk. He's very hawkish against Russia. And he is a downright frothing, rabid warmonger on Iran.
Right. Other than that, what's your problem?
Yeah. With him, you know, he equates Iran to ISIS. Never mind the fact that they're diametrically opposed.
Right.
And,
yeah, right.
And you know,
well, in his defense, so does the U.S. court system. I mean,
yeah,
if
right.
you look at the lawsuits over 9/11, and there's another one where some survivors just brought a lawsuit with naming both Saudi Arabia and Iran as parties defendant.
Well, that of course the absurdity of that when Saudi and Saudi Arabia and Iran are regional hegemonic opponents of
right.
the tallest order,
right.
representing entirely different and violently opposed strains of Islam.
Right.
You know, Shia and Sunni on the one side, the whole divide
And geopolitics, by the way.
And
right.
geopolitics, yeah. Well, I think if you take a look at the U.S.'s own list of terrorists, and you see that there is only one or two on that whole list that in any – Hezbollah being the major – that can be in any way linked to Iran, and it has to be noted that much of the world does not consider Hezbollah a terrorist organization. All of the other organizations on that list are linked to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So who's the biggest supporter of terrorists, right, the U.S. Right, ally that we
right,
are?
Right,
but,
right.
you know, that's clear from the U.S.'s own records. Yeah, but so I'm not getting a warm fuzzy from Mike Pompeo replacing the Secretary of State. Even more disturbing is who replaces Mike Pompeo. And this is Gina Haspel.
Yeah.
She is the deputy director of the CIA. She's a woman. She's the first woman, you know. Wow, what a great belated Women's Day president. We have a woman to head the CIA. Not just any woman, but a woman who operated one of the Bush-era black torture sites
right.
in Thailand.
Right.
She was an undercover for a good part of her role. Then she ran this torture site. Not only did she run the site, but according to The Intercept and according to these CIA documents that were released via WikiLeaks, she literally tortured two detainees. One of the detainees was waterboarded 83 times, right? And had his hands repeatedly beat against walls for hours and numerous other gruesome punishments until it was determined that he actually had no useful information. Now, not only did she run these sites and torture is a war crime, right?
Yeah.
Torture is a war crime. And no one in the U.S. government above the rank of a few people in the low-level military people who were caught in Abu Ghraib up to what amounted to torture shenanigans, stupidly taping themselves do it. No one in U.S. intelligence was ever punished for any of this. There was no accountability. Yeah. There was no justice. There was nothing. In fact, Gina Haspel was promoted. She was first deputy director of the CIA. Now she is being nominated for the director of the CIA, a torturer, not just running torture, a hands-on torturer.
Yeah, right.
Is the director of the CIA. She has never repudiated torture. Mike Pompeo, by the way, is in favor of torture. He doesn't consider waterboarding and these other things to be torture. I suggest he subject his children to that. Then, right? And we know that Trump also thinks that torture is a great idea.
Well,
so, I mean, certainly, I it will be very laughable to if we have Mike Pompeo, go back to the U.S. State Department practice of screaming about human rights in one hand while praising torture.
Right, exactly.
In the other.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I mean, but in a way, it's so perfect.
Yeah,
when you
it
think
is.
About it.
Well,
it perfectly illustrates the hypocrisy, you know, right there. But this Gina Haspel, I think it is the most. It should be the most disturbing to Americans that she is now being nominated and will probably be approved. I don't expect the Democrats to offer more than a token voice of caution during the nomination hearings.
They'll savage her so and tag Trump with it, but then they'll let her get.
They'll get it just like just like they let through. They called Trump a tyrant, and then approve increased surveillance powers.
Right.
And then continue to authorize the 2001-2003 authorization of military force, which the U.S. has used as an excuse to maintain a constant war throughout the Middle East for the last 15 years. But Trump is a madman and he's a tyrant, but let's continue to make sure he has that power, right? Well,
okay, so we've got like a minute left and we haven't really even touched what's going on in the UK and all of that. So
that's just insanity at this point. There's no evidence that Russia is involved other than this chemical agent, which we know the whole basis of it is that it was produced in the Soviet Union in the late 70s. It's a nerve agent, supposedly 10 times more powerful than VX. It's kind of still kind of a hush-hush thing. Not much is known about it, except that the guy who developed it is a defector living in the United States, and the U.S. helped Uzbekistan in the early years of the breakup of the Soviet Union dismantle the production facilities for it. So the U.S. has it.
Right.
The U.K. has admitted that they have it because that's how they positively identified what it was.
Exactly.
Because British papers said they have samples of it that they acquired via clandestine means. We know that the Ukraine has it, right?
Yeah.
At the very least among the other post-Soviet states. And I mean, what greater motivation to continue to receive Western support for the war against their own people in the Donbass and to continue to demonize Russia than to kill off a 66-year-old British double agent who had already served years in prison, was caught, had served years in prison. Nothing was done to him. They released him in a prisoner swap. He lived in the UK for a decade.
Well, it's austerity. He's just starting to draw his pension. Let's save the money. Look, we got to stop here because we're out of time. Maybe Friday we can get into this because I would really like to look at – you have all these moving parts right now and a presidential election on Sunday. And I'm wondering if one of these moving parts isn't going to try to blow up to have some kind of an impact or maybe several of them to try to have some multiple impacts on the elections. Maybe
sure, I'm sure they're trying lots of these things, but it won't have the reaction they wanted.
I agree with that. Cool. All right, so we'll talk again later this week. Mark, thank you very much. A pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. The recent series of events on the North Korean track has upended many diplomatic conventions. Not only have the South Koreans become the unlikely messengers between Pyongyang and Washington, they've also become spokespeople for both. Can Donald Trump's supposed acceptance of Kim Jong-un's supposed invitation for talks break this decades-old stalemate? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Andrei Lenkov, professor at Kukmin University in Seoul. Professor Lenkov, it's good to have you on the show. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. At your service.
Now, we've just witnessed a major turnaround in how North Korea and the United States approach one another. Just a few weeks ago, the world feared the breakout of a nuclear war. Now we are discussing the potentiality of the first ever face-to-face meeting between the two leaders since the Korean War. What do you think accounts for this dramatic shift?
Well, I would say cynically, blackmail works. Because over the last year, the U.S. administration, or pretty well, let's be more precise, President Trump himself, has worked very hard to create an impression that he is seriously considering a military operation against North Korea. Nobody but President Trump himself can possibly know whether he was really going to strike North Korea, or perhaps it was all bluffing to create such an impression and to get political and diplomatic results. Whether sincere or not, this policy of pressure has finally worked. First, China, from August-September, suddenly changed its attitude to sanctions targeting North Korea. Historically, China was remarkably reluctant to support really tough sanctions against North Korea, but from August of September, China is probably in some regards tougher than the United States. So they try to show that they are working very hard.
So essentially what you're saying is that Donald Trump managed to change the calculus of not only the North Koreans, but also other parties to this conflict. But North Koreans do not have a reputation of being particularly feeble-minded. In fact, I think they have a reputation of being very tough negotiators and trying to get as much as possible for as little as possible. And yet, all of a sudden, they show this openness for one-sided concessions, agreeing to suspend military and ballistic tests while not asking the Americans to suspend their military exercises. Is that a measure of how frightened they are, or perhaps a calculation that on their part that they may get more in return later on?
Both. Personally, I'm pretty sure that in the long run, the North Koreans will outsmart Americans, will outsmart South Koreans, because, you know, I've been studying their history, and this is history of how well Kim Jong-un and his father, and especially his grandfather, manipulated Chinese, Russians, South Koreans, Americans, Japanese, and they always were with us. But right now, they are still frightened. Because I mentioned the Chinese sanctions. They are yet to produce impact, but in due time, situation is likely to deteriorate. And of course, they don't want to be shot at. They understand, in case of war, they can inflict a great deal of damage on the US and their allies. But they also understand that in the end of the day, they are going to suffer much more. So they don't want a shooting war. And if they presume that this is what's going to happen, if they don't stop, well, they decided to stop. And as a matter of fact, actually, they introduced moratorium on the missile tests and nuclear launches. Not now. Now they just confirmed it. For all practical purposes, they did it in late November.
And they also floated a possibility of being open to discuss the so-called denuclearization of the peninsula. Now, I know from your own writing that it sounds big, but it doesn't carry much, at least in your view. But do you think there's anything that could actually prompt Pyongyang to take this issue seriously and consider it?
I don't see any scenario which would probably make North Koreans to seriously consider denuclearization. Their current statement is basically just a lip service. Many people forget, but according to the 1968 treaties signed by all major nuclear powers, including United States, Russia and China and France and United Kingdom, all these countries are under obligation to eventually surrender their nuclear weapons. When you read official American or Russian or Chinese documents, you see that this is not exactly what they are working hard to achieve. So it's just a lip service. And North Koreans can easily do the same. They can easily do what the Americans or Russians have been doing for decades. Just to say, in one beautiful point, in a very distant future, probably we will surrender nuclear weapons. Not now.
Professor Lenkov, you mentioned the lip service, and I think it's also become a bit of a diplomatic ritual to endorse the denuclearization of the peninsula. But if we look at it through realpolitik lenses, do you think regional powers like Russia, like China, actually want Pyongyang to fully disarm?
Absolutely. Because it's very often misunderstood. But the Russian government has always been deadly against nuclear North Korea. And the same or even more is applicable to China. You know, Russia is now flooded with anti-American feelings, so many people say, wow, they're against the United States, they're good guys, let's support them. No. Because in the end of the day, first of all, Russia, being economy-wise, weaker than other nuclear countries, needs nuclear superiority even more. And it has no interest in emergence of new nuclear powers, because there will be copycats. Now it's North Korea, tomorrow it may be South Korea. They are discussing it seriously, Taiwan, Vietnam. And the more nuclear powers are around, the less military significant Russia becomes. And it's only part of the story. Another part of the story is just old good proliferation. North Koreans are known to be proliferators.
Well, but the counter argument to that would be that the North Korean partial nuclear arsenal provides security guarantees not only to the regime itself, but also to its neighbors against a military intervention, the breakout of a major war on their borders. And as you pointed out in one of your recent articles, nobody wants to see a replay of the Libyan events in East Asia. So my question to you is whether North Korea having a short nuclear stick, not a fully developed, but some semblance of a nuclear weapon. Doesn't that provide a certain guarantee to both Russia and China that the United States would not intervene recklessly on their borders?
No. Security guarantees for Russia are provided by the Russia Nuclear and Missile Forces, period. All other countries, if they develop nuclear weapons, they create, in the long run, increase instability. I'm not saying that we can do anything about North Korean nuclear weapons. I'm just saying that from the point of view of the Russian national interest, it's not a good news. Look, now it's North Korea. But if North Korea becomes nuclear, it will become only logical for South Korea to go nuclear as well. Because, yes, now North Koreans say and probably believe that they need nuclear weapons for defense. But let's not forget, it was the North Korea which invaded South Korea in 1950. And it's still official line is that South Korea does not exist. South Korea is an U.S.-occupied territory to be eventually liberated. It's not much repeated, but if, according to the North Korean constitution, this is the situation. So what should South Koreans do? Probably develop nukes. And if it happens, what about Japan? What about Taiwan? What about Vietnam? All these countries have a lot of reasons to develop nukes. By the way, most cases against China. And this is the reason why China is so unhappy about North Korean nuclear program. Russia is a bit unhappy. China is seriously unhappy because if it's not stopped, in 10, 15, 20 years' time, China will find itself surrounded by small, really hostile countries, which has reasons to hate China going back to many centuries, and each country with a nuclear weapons.
Professor Lengo, I heard you say that the North Korean regime is likely to be accommodating as long as it believes that the U.S. administration could be reckless enough to launch a strike against it, despite all the potential ramifications for South Korea as well as for the region in general. How much mileage do you think the Trump administration can get out of it? What's the maximum that they can potentially extort from Pyongyang by using these scare tactics?
Well, I would say a lot. Actually, what I heard over last week, it's basically that they can get much more than I realistically expected. North Koreans essentially accepted the joint military exercises. Well, perhaps it's the same situation I just discussed when we were talking about desirability of the nuclear program. Because if they have, basically they know they can do nothing about joint military exercises. Nonetheless, for last few months, it did look like that the future deal will include at least something about the scale or continuation or frequency of the joint exercises. And recently, North Koreans essentially said, military exercises are okay with us. We don't care. We don't worry about it. Which was a pretty massive concession. So I would say that, about a year ago, 2 years ago, I used to say, and many other observers said, well, sooner or later, North Koreans probably will sit down and start talking. But they are going to extract a lot of everything from the United States, South Korea, all other interested parties. Now, it seems that North Koreans' major condition is, first, to make sure that Americans will not start shooting. Second, to have some of the recent sanctions lifted as soon as possible before it will strike the economy. And they are not going to put much more demands for the time being.
Now, Professor Linkov, there is a lot of discussion in the United States, especially among those who do not support the idea of the presidential summit, that it would be encouraging North Korea for its bad behavior. But I think the relevant question here is also whether it would encourage Trump for his bad behavior, because you mentioned that his policy of essentially blackmail has worked so far. If that summit indeed takes place, wouldn't that make bellicosity on the American part a more acceptable form of foreign policy? I know that for the time being, both Russia and China are endorsing the idea of the meeting between Kim and Trump, but I suppose they wouldn't be just as happy to have Trump threaten them in the same manner.
Last time I checked, Russia and China has much more force and much more, they are much more capable of biting back. And nobody would treat either Russia or China in such a way. So, yes, it's a kind of a bad example, but let's face it. North Koreans for decades have used same blackmail tactics. For me, it's a bit funny to see how the same tricks, which for decades have been favorable tricks of Pyongyang, are now used with the same efficiency against Pyongyang. It's a bit funny to see when basically, you know, Donald Trump tried to out Kim Jong-un himself. It's a bit for funny, all this fire and fury and all this stuff. But I don't think it's going to be applied on a similar scale to any serious opponent. North Korea is dangerous, but it's basically still a rather small and very poor country.
Well, certainly nobody likes to get a taste of his or her own medicine. Professor Lenkov, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Andrei Lenkov, professor at Kukmin University in Seoul. Now, Professor Lenkov, just before the break, you commended Donald Trump on the success, at least initial success, of his blackmail tactics. But the news of the last few moments, and we are recording this show on Tuesday, is that Donald Trump decided to fire his chief diplomat, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. My question to you is whether Donald Trump at this point of time has the team to capitalize on these initial diplomatic gains. Does he actually have negotiators, the diplomats who would take this initial success and develop it into something more concrete?
Well, negotiating is going to be tough. This is a major problem because it's an open secret that President Trump despises his diplomats. And, well, I would say the feelings are largely reciprocated. Therefore, over last, say, year or so, a lot of highly skilled people have left the State Department. And essentially now, they don't have a single person who has experience of negotiating with the North Koreans. Most people in the State Department Korean team are newcomers. It's a big problem how well they are going to develop the great strategic success. Let's admit it, it was a strategic success achieved by President's diplomacy. I'm a bit skeptical because North Koreans are very good, very tough negotiators. They don't change their teams for years, for many years to come. Some of people have been negotiating with the Americans for 20 years. And these people know all the weak points and probably will take advantage of it. So, well, it's not probably a good news, because if everything becomes a mess, it will be bad news not only for the United States, not only for North Korea, it will be bad news for South Korea, for China, and of course for the Russian Federation.
Now, you mentioned both Russia and China, and I think up until recently, at least, both of them have expressed cautious endorsement of this initiative. You know that Moscow has even gone as far as to suggest that this summit may take place in Moscow. That offer, I think, was downplayed later on in the Kremlin, but I think it's still on the table. Do you think there is any chance of either Russia or China stepping into the void and helping the Trump administration to secure this deal for the benefit of global security? We have to thread very carefully here not to invite any accusations of collusion, but at the end of the day, I think we would all agree that the peace on the Korean Peninsula is in the best interest of humanity, isn't it?
Not only humanity. Humanity is something abstract, but as I have argued just a few minutes ago, peace in Korean Peninsula is an interest of Russia. Because Russian interest and for basically Chinese interest are very simple. First, Russia wants stability. Second, Russia wants status quo. Third, Russia wants denuclearization. If Mr. Trump, if President Trump did mean business, if he was really going to deliver a strike against North Korea, a massive war, not necessarily nuclear war, but a massive war was the most likely outcome. Therefore, any kind of reduction in tension is a good news for Russia. However, talking about a possible negotiation in Moscow, well, until recently, it would be a good idea to have North-South Korean summit, or say, summits between North Korean leaders and US president or other Western leaders. It would be a good idea to have them in Russia. Maybe not necessarily in Moscow. Vladivostok is a wonderful city too. You can be sure. Or maybe in my native Petersburg. Why not? Maybe not Moscow, but not now. The sad truth is, right now, Russian issue is very big in the United States. Probably it has never been the case that Russia attracted so much unfavorable attention, well, since maybe the 1950s, since the anti-communist fear, anti-communist scare. So it would not be probably a good idea if Russia is too much involved in these negotiations. Not now. In the long run, yes, but now it's probably safer to just watch, maybe occasionally help to sort out the situation, because, well, sometimes Russia would be happy to see Americans in trouble, but in Korea, such troubles are very easy can develop into Russia's own trouble.
There is an actual commitment from Kim Jong-un to having the summit with South Korean leader President Moon Jae-in next month. And if that happens, that would also be, I suppose, a major breakthrough, the third such summit in history. Who do you think has more at stake at this meeting? And do you see it as a stepping stone towards a meeting with Trump? Or does it have a value in and of itself?
Largely a stepping stone. Because surprisingly, South Korea is a generally very pro-American country. Even the political forces which used to be anti-American in the past, like, say, supporters of the current president, they are much, much more favorable about the United States now, which, however, does not mean that they like a particular U.S. president. However, nonetheless, in spite of all this, right now, North Korea and South Korea are in the same boat. Because in the long run, the North Korean nuclear weapons constitute a massive danger for the South Korean, but it's for maybe in the long run, maybe when we are talking decades. Right now, the major threat South Korea faces is a threat of a military operation initiated by the United States, which can easily escalate into a war. And if we have a war, it will be North and South Koreans who are going to die in really large numbers. So right now, South Korean interest is to reduce tensions.
Do I understand you correctly that you're essentially suggesting that South Korea fears Donald Trump a little bit more than it fears Kim Jong-un?
Yes, as an immediate threat, yes. It's a tactical threat. In the long run, of course, Kim Jong-un is a problem for South Koreans, but in the short run, it was probably Mr. Trump. So I think that they're basically playing together, North and South Korea, just to reduce the tension, to create the impression that now North Koreans are ready to talk and they are ready to make concessions. And they are indeed actually ready to talk and indeed ready to make concessions. Talking about the North-South Korean summit, unfortunately, South Korean president has very little freedom of action. It cannot promise any kind of economic assistance to North Korea, because such assistance would be a violation not only of the U.S. policy, but of the internationally approved U.N. sanctions. It's not in position to talk about the military issues, because it's going to be blocked by the United States as well. And of course, everything related to the nuclear problem is exclusively an area where, or an area of the exclusive American interest. So basically, they can smile, discuss the quality of meat and barbecue, maybe approve some kind of nice cultural exchanges, you know, circus going there, taekwondo fighters and, you know, athletes going here, but they cannot discuss anything serious. So it largely will be a stepping stone to the summit between Trump and Kim, summit which will really can open path for future negotiations and cooperation and exchanges between two Korean states.
Having said that, I think what at least I find very fascinating is this new role that the South Koreans found themselves in, because they are essentially now acting as messengers between Pyongyang and Washington rather than, you know, being a separate party to the conflict. And I think that's a very interesting development. I don't think we've ever had South Korean officials communicating to the Americans what the North Koreans want. Do you see any, do you see that as a positive development for the inner Korean negotiations? Because I suppose that when you act as a, not necessarily as a mediator, but at least as a go-between, your optics shift a little bit. And I think you try to prepare the base for compromise a little bit more than you would if you were acting in your own capacity.
Don't worry. They will try really hard to prepare base for compromise. Because if shooting starts, it will be the South Koreans who are going to die in large numbers, including a lot of people in the top political elite. So they are working hard. Don't worry. And talking about their role, which is indeed surprising, and it's also unnecessary. Because both North Koreans and Americans are perfectly capable of negotiating between themselves. And contrary to what most people suspect, the kind of clandestine, unofficial, secret channels of communication between Washington and Pyongyang have always been operational. What I'm saying, they not only can talk, they have been talking for all this time. And the decision to include North Korea, South Korea, is largely done because, first of all, North Korean diplomats want to use it to drive the wedge between South Korea and United States. And they also want to create sort of a united front with the South Korean government, because for the time being, as I have said, for both North and South Korea, a possible military operation by the Americans constitute a greater threat than a theoretical possibility of their war between themselves, which is not going to happen anytime soon. So they want a sort of united front. And Americans also would like to give some kind of, to make some gestures to emphasize the significance of the South Koreans, to show that basically it's not about playing some games behind their back.
But Professor Linkov, I think it was reported in the New York Times just the other day that South Korean officials are serving not only as messengers between Pyongyang and Washington, but essentially the Americans are making them play the role of spokespeople, because at the end of the day, it was a South Korean official who announced Trump's willingness to negotiate with the North. Is that a form of hedging risks on the part of the Trump administration, or simply his lack of knowledge about how the diplomatic niceties are supposed to work out? Because I think it's also pretty unprecedented to have a North Korean official to communicate the will of the American president to the world.
Neither. It's exactly what I have just said. South Koreans are valuable now for the Americans, and American administration and maybe American diplomacy wants to emphasize their significance. And this is why such an unprecedented measure was taken. Basically, Americans are sending signal to Seoul, you are a part of the team. You probably objectively can do very little, but we take you very seriously, and we are going to give you a lot of extra rights because you are a part of the team. And basically, North Koreans are also sending to South Korea a somewhat similar signal. Look, we both are afraid of this strange guy in the White House. It's in our joint interest to reduce the tension for the time being. Maybe in 20 years down the track, we are going to fight one another and exchange nuclear strikes, because God knows South Korea can easily go nuclear eventually. But for the time being, our major problem is across the ocean. Let's act together.
Well, Professor Lankov, I guess you can find a silver lining even in the darkest cloud. And if Trump's unpredictability provides for this bonding experience between the two Koreas, so be it. Anyway, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your being on the show today. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.